Welcome to Sarah's Bookshelves Live. I'm Sarah of the blog Sarah's Bookshelves. Each week, I'm talking with one bookish guest about two old books they love, two new books they love, one book they don't love, and one new release they're excited about. We're going to get real and sometimes a bit snarky about all things books. If you like the show, I'd really love your support. Spread the word to your reader friends, subscribe to the show, rate and review it wherever you listen to podcasts, or get bonus podcast episodes by supporting the podcast on Patreon. There's a link in the show notes and in my Instagram bio to my Patreon page. Let's get rolling. Hey, everyone. Welcome to a full-length episode of Sarah's Bookshelves Live. I know it's been a while since I've been on the air and been able to talk to y'all, and I am thrilled to be back after a couple weeks off. Actually, it was more than a couple weeks, maybe a month or so. And while I would love to tell you it was rejuvenating, it was probably a little bit less than rejuvenating from a personal standpoint. We just had a lot going on at home, and I was thankful that I was able to take a break from the podcast for that reason. But it was really rejuvenating in the sense of I've had time to think and plan for what the podcast is going to look like, and I am really glad to be rolling again. And I couldn't have a better guest to start back with. Catherine Adele West, who is the author of the debut novel Saving Ruby King, is joining me today. Saving Ruby King came out in June, and I absolutely loved it. It's one of the best books I've read this year so far, and it's still stuck in my head even though I read it well over a month ago. Catherine was born and raised in Chicago, where she still lives. She graduated with both her bachelor's and master's of science in journalism from the University of Illinois at Urbana. Her work is published in Black Fox Literary Magazine, 5-to-1, Better Than Starbucks, that's a great name, by the way, Doors Ajar, 805 Lit and Art, The Helix Magazine, Lunch Ticket, and Gay Magazine. In between writing and traveling, Catherine works as an editor. Welcome, Catherine.
Thank you so much for having me, Sarah. I greatly appreciate it.
Well, I'm so excited to talk to you. This book has just really hit me in a good place as far as my reading, and it had such an impact on me, and I can't wait to be able to talk to the source.
I love that, the source.
The source, the horse's mouth. So can you tell us a little bit about Saving Ruby King for those listeners who haven't had a chance to read it yet?
Sure. Saving Ruby King is about the lengths one girl will go to named Layla to save her friend Ruby when a murder upends their tight-knit church community. It's a book about love, faith, redemption, hope, and the Black community and how the church can play a part in that.
I understand that the original seed for you to write a book, not necessarily this particular book, although it ended up being that, came at a wedding. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what inspired you to write this particular story about this place and these characters?
I was doing short stories, but you know, you don't really make, you know, a ton of money at it. And so I was telling a friend of mine, an old college classmate, an idea for a story that I had. And she's like, you should write a book. You should write a book. Like, that's just not like a short story. That's a book. And I'm like, oh my God, I should write a book. And how hard can it be if I have like a bachelor's and a master's in journalism? It's really freaking hard.
I was just going to say, oh, I bet it can be hard.
Yeah, I was just like, oh no, it's not going to be hard. Like, I mean, I wrote for like 5-6 years in college. What's the problem with writing? I can write. Like, this shouldn't be a problem. Yeah, no, it was a problem. Like, it was a problem. I didn't know what I was doing. And I still keep the first page or two that I typed just to remind me of how far I came and also to never let my head get too big. So, you know, when wonderful people like you come along and just say, it was a 5-star read and this was like one of the best books of the year. And I'm like, uh-huh, yeah, it didn't start out that way.
How close were those original first two pages to the first two pages we actually saw in the book?
Oh, yeah. So they have the words and the.
Yes, that's similar.
It's not the same at all. It is vastly, completely, crazily different. If I gave you the rough draft of what I finished in 2017, as opposed to the hardcover now, you would be astonished at how far and how different the book is. The book actually had an additional point of view. And a whole nother timeline in the 70s.
Oh, wow. Who was the additional point of view from?
Holden, the cop at the end. And get into the 70s, because then you would learn more about kind of what happened with a character named Cyrus and what was kind of going on in the 70s in Chicago with the police in particular versus the African-American community.
I love hearing the evolution of sort of seed and idea to final product.
Oh, yeah, it was interesting, and it was longer. What ended up happening was when I was querying the book, there was an agent who was, you know, really, really nice. And she gave me feedback like, this is what was working for me with the book and this is what wasn't. And if you work on these things, you know, feel free to send me the revised version of your book. So I spent 5 months tearing the book in half. I literally, like, the book was in half. Once I took out everything she didn't like, I was about 40,000 words and I had to rebuild from there.
Wow.
This was in January of 2018 is when I got the reply back from that agent. And I was devastated. I was like sitting on my chair crying. And I was just like, why, God, why? And after I gave myself like 5 minutes to feel sorry for myself, I began the process of completely, you know, redoing the book, essentially. Like I said, I cut out half of the book, started from there and rebuilt it. That took me 5 months.
Oh, wow.
And then the agent still ended up passing. And then once again, I was just completely devastated.
Oh.
I completely redid this book. And you but she was so nice. But the thing was, I found my agent, Beth Marche. You know, the other agent had not given me these suggestions. I probably wouldn't have landed the agent that I had now.
And how did you find your agent?
So DV Pitt is a pitch contest. I don't know if you heard of it, but it's a pitch contest for diverse and marginalized writers. It happens in October and April on Twitter. And you pitch your book in 280 characters or less.
Oh, wow.
Beth Phelan started this, and it was a godsend for a lot of marginalized writers who, when we send out our queries and our books, kind of really get pushed to the side, or we get agents who are just like, I didn't connect with the voice. I didn't really connect with the characters. And you're like, well, like, characters aren't for a majority white world, or, you know, they're not pandering to the white gaze, and we shouldn't have to. So DV Pitt was just a way for writers and marginalized communities to be able to get their work out there before agents. When you get a like, you can, you know, query that agent. Beth Marche liked my query, and I pitched to her. And then a small indie press came back and said, hey, we want to publish your book. And then I sent out, you know, the notification to all of the agents who had my book. And Beth offered representation along with another agent, and I went with Beth, and I am so happy I did.
Do you happen to remember what your tweet pitch was?
I can find it real quick, but it was something like, I think I compared my book to Big Little Lies.
Ah, interesting.
I think it was like Big Little Lies meets South Side of Chicago. When a murder upends this community, what will this person, you know, what will Layla do in order to help her friend Ruby? It was something kind of in that particular range. But Big Little Lies, A, it's a popular book, and B, it was a book that my agent really, really enjoyed. And then I also mentioned the South Side of Chicago, and she has a huge, huge heart for writers in the South Side of Chicago. And she loves the city of Chicago. So if you're writing about it, she's like, yeah, you know. And so she asked for my full. And once again, when I got the rejection from the other agent, it was just like devastated. That was on a Thursday. I'll never forget, because I moped all the way through the weekend. And then on Monday, I'm at work and I'm, you know, sitting down. And I get an email at 11:27. Never forget that, obviously. 11:27 a.m., I get an email, and it's Beth saying, I love the book. I want to throw my hat in the ring. Can we talk, you know, about representation? And luckily, I didn't scream out loud.
I think it would have been excused had you screamed. That's worth a scream.
I mean, it totally is worth a scream. I was just elated because I couldn't believe that I was finally getting ready to have, like, the quote unquote, the call. And it was fantastic. And it had been about 9 months of querying when I had, you know, landed Beth. So I actually found the tweet.
Oh, good. Let's read it.
So Big Little Lies and 12 Tribes of Hattie meet Southside Chicago. Murder, secrets, and racial disparity affect three generations of a black family inside and outside the walls of a Southside Chicago church.
Oh, that's perfect.
I was really happy because when I had read Big Little Lies, I was amazed at some of the similar themes that it had with Saving Ruby King. 12 Tribes of Hattie is a really well-written literary fiction novel that's multi-POV. I had both. So I had a book with similar themes, which is Big Little Lies. And then I had a book that was structured in a similar way with 12 Tribes of Hattie. I think sometimes where querying writers get caught up is that they think that their book has to be the exact same book that they're, you know, like that they're copying. It needs to be the exact same. And I always tell them like, no. There just have to be similarities. The whole thing is you don't want the book to be the exact same anyway, right? Like you to be different. So when I'm talking to querying writers, I just let them know, don't look for a book that's exactly like yours. Look for a book that has similar themes and or a similar structure and use that as like a jumping off.
And I love it also when you can say, if X book and Y book had a baby, you would get Z book.
Exactly. Exactly.
Can I go back to something you said earlier? You had briefly mentioned how it's hard to get agents to pay attention to stories from marginalized voices. And if you're comfortable sharing, how many different agents did you go to and kind of have trouble getting your foot in the door with this book?
All I want to say, I queried between 60 and 80 agents before I got Beth.
Wow.
I queried that many. And some people say like after 40 or after 50, you should quit. But I don't know what that word means. And I refuse to give up. And I'm happy I didn't because I knew I had something.
And you did.
And Beth was also starting out her agency and definitely was willing to take a chance on, you know, a girl from the South Side of Chicago who just wanted to make her dream come true. And we have a really good relationship, but she knows exactly how to push and when to push and how to make my story better. Saving Ruby King was originally called Potter's Wheel. When Beth got the book, had it not been for Beth, there would be no Ruby King. Ruby King's original name was Louise.
Oh, wow.
See, the thing was, Beth, being an agent who knows her business, said, oh, sweetie, listen, you have like five people in this book and three of them have names that begin with the letter L. You have Layla, Lebanon, and Louise. She was like, I love the names, but it'd be better so it doesn't get so mixed up if you changed either Layla's name or Louise's name. And in the book, Layla would call Louise Lou. So then I was in church. I'm not even playing. And I was like, Lou, Rue, Ruby. So we'll just call her Ruby King instead of Louise King. I didn't think about it because it was still called Potter's Wheel. Laura Brown, who's my editor at Park Row HarperCollins, changed the title of the book from Potter's Wheel to Saving Ruby King. That's how all of that transpired.
Oh, interesting. I always love those stories. So going back to sort of how these characters and this story, like what inspired you to write this story?
It was just a way for me to try to figure out the relationship that I had with my dad. Originally, the book was heavily about Layla and Jackson. Louise and Lebanon weren't part of it.
Oh, wow. Okay. And y'all, for listeners who haven't read the book yet, Layla is Ruby's friend that's trying to help her, and Jackson is her father, who is the pastor of the church.
Exactly. What ended up happening was that you needed something to kind of go against. So it couldn't be like this 300-page book about this father and daughter, just like a diatribe on those types of relationships. Because, I mean, like, let's just call a spade. It'd be like a really boring book. And I wanted something to buck up against. What I wanted to buck up against ended up being Lebanon. But then I'm like, well, if you're going to have Lebanon for Jackson, then you need somebody for Layla. Like you need a mirror, kind of a moral mirror of Layla or you know, a mirror of Layla. So that's how I came up with Ruby. So it wasn't supposed to be so much about Ruby. It was really supposed to be about Layla and Jackson's relationship.
That's so interesting that the like entire central character of your story was somebody totally different.
the whole thing when you're writing a story is that you got to be willing to evolve and change with the story. If you get stagnant or try to put the story in a box, it's not going to work. You know, you're just going to be stuck and you won't know why, or there'll be things in the plot that aren't working. And you won't know why. So you have to be able to kind of like move and groove along with your book. You have to be more like water and not so much like, you know, rock, like earth. You got to change. You got to adapt.
Right. So one of the central themes, and this was probably for me as a reader, the predominant theme and takeaway that I had was sort of the legacy of trauma among these two families, the Kings and the Potters. And that encompassed abuse and intergenerational secrets that sort of perpetuated that abuse, and racism and police brutality. And then how these multiple generations of women in the story use their strength and their friendship and their loyalty to really kind of rise up against all this. And I loved the message of like hope and strength that we got through these women. Can you talk a bit about sort of what you wanted to say through this story about the unique struggles and strengths of women and Black women in particular?
Yeah, I think I wanted to just highlight the strength of Black female relationships. I wanted to highlight how strong Black females have to be and how strong we continue to be despite, you know, any adversity that comes our way. And then somehow managing to amass some kind of hope along the way. I mean, which is a very difficult thing to do. If you feel like the world is constantly like crapping on you, it's hard to have hope. It's hard to figure out where your place is going to be in a world where you don't feel like that world or that nation, namely America, is built for you. Like, how do you fit into that? And I wanted to highlight African-American women and how we're able to, you know, navigate the different societal and racial and religious mores we do find ourselves in. I feel like, you know, African-American women, Black women aren't nearly given as much credit for all we do and all we accomplish within the family, within the home, and without, you know, outside of the home.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm remembering, was there a conversation between Layla and Ruby at some point? And I feel like I'm going to say this on a guess, but I hope I'm not wrong. It's been a little while since I read the book. I think they were talking about their experiences at their respective jobs, about how they felt like African-American women had to work twice as hard to get half the credit.
So in terms of why I felt that it was important to include that or acknowledge that, is because I always feel like African-Americans feel like that. Like we have to work 20 times as hard to get half as much. At least that's, you know, how it's seen from our perspective. So when you go into a job and you're like the only Black person around, and that's, you know, been the case for me a lot of the time, it's like I'm either one of one or one of maybe two or three. You always want to show them, hey, like I deserve to be here and I'm going to work hard. And it really shouldn't be like that because, you know, like if you're walking in as like a white person, you're not like, I'm going to show them I deserve to be there and I'm going to work hard. You know what I mean? Like you do, but not with that type of tension of I can be fired because.
Sure.
If you're Black and you're walking in there and you're literally like one of one, you also kind of feel like you run the risk of representing a whole entire race of people. I mean, fair or unfair, if you mess up or if, you know, you're seen as lazy, oh, so like all Black people are, they might not hire another Black person for like who knows how long because of what they feel you did or didn't do. So like all of that pressure is weighing on us when we're walking into a job. So I mean, since the book already dealt with so many things, I couldn't really make that a major thing, but I felt important. I felt that it was important enough to acknowledge it.
I completely agree. And for me, it felt like it just felt like a very organic part of the characters' lives.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the South Side of Chicago for a minute. You grew up there. The story is set there. So you talk about the outsider perception of the South Side of Chicago in the book. And I feel like you dispelled certain stereotypes that may be perpetuated by the media and things like that through your story. What did growing up on the South Side of Chicago, what was that like for you? And what did that mean for you personally?
It was a great experience for me. It still is. I still live on the South Side of Chicago. I think when you're talking about dispelling some of the kind of myths, it was like, you know, there are two parent homes.
Sure.
Up in one. He, you know, went to church. My dad worked for the post office and he was, you know, he's a pastor. And my mom is a teacher and a principal. And my brother is an artist. And, you know, I mean, like it was like growing up anywhere else. We played outside. We had candy stores that we went to. It's just that the Black experience is different and colors things in a different way. So we have little traditions that are passed down from generation to generation. We have our church or the Black church where, you know, we all grew up in. It was a really good way to grow up for me. It also taught me to work extremely hard. That's like the whole thing with, you know, Layla feeling like she has to work 20 times as hard. And it's not because you just need to prove yourself. It's because you need to make sure that the generation before you and the generation before them, that their sacrifices aren't in vain. And, you know, I don't know. Like, I don't know how many times I have to say that though the South Side of Chicago has its issues, has no more than, you know, the North Side of Chicago has issues too. It's just that those aren't kind of emblazoned upon the television consistently, like, and 30-second clips all the time. It's not like, you know, when people tend to interview, they don't find people like me who are just like, okay, and this is what happened, and this is what happened. It's some kind of like kind of crazy need to fit a narrative that isn't all there is to us. I mean, that's honestly like the best way I can say it. But in terms of me growing up on the South Side of Chicago, it shaped me as a person and it made me who I am. And I wouldn't, you know, good, bad, and ugly, I wouldn't trade a moment of it.
And I think setting is another thing in this book that just comes alive. I feel like it was another character.
That makes me really, really happy. That makes me feel like I know my city.
Yes. I've never been to Chicago, but I felt like it was incredibly vivid and vibrant. And speaking of other inanimate characters in your book, let's talk about the church.
I knew we were going there, Sarah. I knew we were going.
When I was reading along and I'm like, oh, the church is a narrator. And then I was like, oh, I don't know about this because I've read books before where inanimate objects were narrators. There's one I'm thinking about that was a painting. And it just didn't work for me. This totally worked for me. It was this like fly on the wall sort of gossipy element that I loved. And how did you make this choice? And I do think that readers that I've heard from that have picked up this book since I read it, this is like the first thing people talk about.
Well, what happened was, remember all those reiterations of Saving Ricky? We're talking about an early, early reiteration years and years ago. I want to say like 2013, 2014, I let a former coworker of mine read. His name was Luke Salazar. And he read it and he was like, it's good, you know, but like, did you think about maybe making the church a narrator, you know, or like making the church a POV? And I was like, oh my God, that's brilliant. Because honestly, I hadn't heard of anything like that before. So when you were talking about that book where like the painting was a narrator, I'm like, I've never heard of that ever. Like, I didn't hear about that. I don't know the book to which you're referring, but
I can't even remember the name of the book. It was one I didn't finish, but I do remember the painting as the narrator.
I was like, I've never heard of that. That is a brilliant idea. Yeah, let's do it. You know, like I was like, yeah, Kathy, like, let's do it. And the thing is, when it came to the church, it was a nice way to give information without info dumping.
Right.
It also allowed me to scratch this itch where I love to write in a very just timeless and classical way, but you can't have your characters talk like that. Like this isn't a Charles Dickens novel. You know, I can't have my characters express themselves in this particular manner, but a timeless church, a church that's like 200 years old, can speak like that. So I took a lot of my older literary influences and some more so modern African-American influences. So, you know, I did the Charles Dickens and the Oscar Wilde, but then, you know, you mix in some James Baldwin and some Octavia Butler, and that's where I get my amalgam of, you know, kind of literary influence in terms of how I allow the church or how I have the church express itself. So it was just a really nice way for me to kind of scratch that itch, because I don't always get to do that. If you have to write in a modern way, you can't afford to, you know, have like literary classical or like all my lovely poetic flowery language, you know, but like I can use it for a church. So it was just, it was so wonderful to just get all of that out, because it was just in me and I needed to get it out.
I think also it was a great way to allow the reader in on some secrets that like the characters didn't know about yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also with the church, your father is a pastor.
Yes.
And one of the themes that kind of jumped out at me as it relates to faith and church in this story was that faith and church maybe aren't always exactly the same thing. Can you talk a little bit about that as sort of your experience growing up as the daughter of a pastor and your relationship with your own faith?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of, like you said, faith and church aren't always the same thing. There's a line in the book where Jackson is talking to his wife, Joanna, and he said, you know, we have to place God above all else. And she was like, no, you place the church above us, not God.
Yes.
So it's just one of those things where in terms of my faith, I don't think that my struggles with it detracted from the book. I think it enhanced the book because, you know, I have questions about my faith.
Sure.
But the thing is, the whole point of faith is the journey in it, how you figure out where your place is in terms of faith, or if you choose not to have a faith or believe in anything at all. Me personally, I don't. I'm a Christian proudly, but then also kind of walking that fine line when you're writing your book, not to come off sounding like preachy or like you're trying to convert somebody, because like that's not what I'm trying to do.
Right.
I think that some, you know, sometimes like it doesn't work with people. I remember reading one review where it said Jackson, the pastor, came off as preachy. And I remember being like, but he's a pastor.
Exactly. That's his job.
So I think that my struggles in terms of faith and figuring out where I am with that lended itself to the book and helped me explore exactly where I am with it. And then in terms of my dad, it helped me to discover and to diagnose exactly how the church, how the Black church in particular, played a role in our relationship, whether it was good or bad. So that was just like another kind of way. It was just like another way Saving Ruby King essentially like helped me. Like, I mean, writing the book in its own way obviously was pretty cathartic. And I owe a great deal to this book, you know, meeting lovely people such as yourself, but also figuring out even more who I am as a person, as an artist, as a sister, daughter, etc.
And what does your dad think of the book?
He loved it.
Good.
Yeah, I honestly thought he wasn't going to read it.
Really?
Oh, I did a podcast where I so trash talked my dad, and I told him, like, I'm completely honest with my dad. So I told him, I was like, I said that I did not think that he was going to read the book. Or if he said he did, he probably lied just to, you know, try to make me feel better. And I had to eat my words. I had a nice big plate of crow. Because my dad read twice. He read the book twice.
And did he read it before or after it came out?
He read it after it came out. I didn't let my family, and I still won't let my family read any of my books until after they come out. With the exception of my brother. My brother did read like a very, very early draft of the book, but the draft that he read as opposed to what's here now was like two different stories anyway. But my mom and my dad, I refuse to let them read the book until it's hardcover in their hands. And that's something that I think I'll just continue to do. Not because I'm afraid of any type of feedback or anything like that. It's just that I prefer them to see the final product.
Well, it sounds like it looked pretty different from the original, which we talked about earlier.
Yeah, it was so, like I said, it was so different. You had another timeline and another POV.
So let's talk a little bit about what you're working on now. I heard some rumors that there might be a prequel in the works.
Yeah. You know, so, you know, prayerfully, you know, HarperCollins picks this up. but it is a prequel focusing on Sarah and her time in Memphis, Tennessee. I think once people see Sarah, they're just like, she is a mean old woman. Like, why is she so mean? And what did Lebanon ever do to her? And then we find out about Sarah's upbringing in Saving Ruby King.
Yep.
And then you're like, oh. But then there's a scene where, you know, she talks about being in Memphis for a short time, and it alludes to some really good times and something, you know, tragic. And I really wanted to explore that story. I honestly think I knew near the end of the book what my second book was going to be. I didn't really know that, like, Saving Ruby King was going to be really a series, but that's kind of how it's shaping up. I kind of think there'll probably be around 3 or 4 books in all.
That is the best news. Wow. We are in for a treat.
In between there, I definitely want to work on other books because I don't want to get pigeonholed.
And I think the character of Sarah I think there's so much more to mine there. I'm really looking forward to reading more of her backstory. And y'all, for those who haven't read the book yet, Sarah is Lebanon's mother. Lebanon is Ruby King's father. So Sarah is Ruby's grandmother. All right, let's get into your book recommendations.
Yes, let's.
As usual, Catherine is going to share 2 old books she loves, 2 new books she loves, 1 book she does not love, and 1 upcoming release she's excited about, which actually ties back into some of our conversation earlier. And this book has been on my radar for months now, and I'm so excited about it too. So tell me about the first old book you love.
So the first old book I love is A Little Life by Hanya Yanagihara.
Yes.
I mean, you thought my book was heartbreaking. Lord Jesus.
Uh-huh.
This book just killed me, then brought me back to life, and then would kill me again. I was just so enthralled with the characters of Jude, Willem, Malcolm, and JB that, I mean, I think about this book so often. Like, these characters haunt me in the best ways. I'm just wondering when HBO can just do a limited series. Heck, once I become a famous author, I will help produce. I will put money behind it. I just need this book to become a limited series.
That is going to be one hard thing to watch. Whoa.
It will be. Just get your tissues out. It's cool. We do it when we watch it. This Is Us.
Yep, sure.
So, like, A Little Life by Hanya Yanagihara is just like, just this breathtaking epic tale of, you know, brotherhood and sacrifice and secrets, which I'm apparently really big on in my book.
Yes. Makes a good book.
Yeah. I mean, it really did. It makes an excellent book. I just think that it's just one of the best books I've read in the past, like, 5 years. Like, I'm easily one of the best books I've read in the past 5 years.
I loved it too. And I read it before it came out, so it wasn't as prevalently talked about, the level of brutality in there. I kind of thought I was going in and reading a male version of The Interestings. Boy, was I surprised. But I don't mind emotional books. I don't mind really traumatic things happening in books. I will say it was one of the most consuming and emotional reading experiences of my entire life.
I'll just say it like this without, you know, ruining it, even though the book has been out for years. But,
right.
You know, but no spoilers here. I will just vaguely say, near the end of the section labeled The Happy Years with Willem.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I was on the train when that happened.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So, didn't know. And this is like pre-COVID. So, like, I'm just on the train, just kicking it, just trying to live my happy life. And what happens with Willem happens with Willem. And I'm on the train and I yell, no. No. And then everybody's looking at me and I'm like, oh, I'm sorry, I'm reading a book.
Yeah, this is one of those that is hard to read in public.
I remember I talked about A Little Life on Instagram, and Hanya Yanagihara reached out to me and said that she wishes me well with my book journey and she hopes to read my book soon. And after I revived myself, I ended up rereading A Little Life again.
Oh, wow. You read it twice.
I don't know why I did that.
I mean, man, yeah, that book So, so good. I mean, that book has a place on my shelves as well.
My other book is Kindred by Octavia Butler.
Yes.
So once again, just this book isn't nearly as long as A Little Life. This book is like a quarter of the size of A Little Life, but like A Little Life is like over eight. And it's like 120 pages or something like that. So Kindred by Octavia Butler was just a book that it literally changed me. Like, I thought I knew what writing was until I read, you know, James Baldwin and Octavia Butler. And I'm like, I don't know, Jack. I was just like, I should just pack it up. Kindred, it changes you, you know? It really redefined like how I really even moved in the world as a Black woman. And then in terms of how Butler kind of constructed the story with Dana and just like the going back in time and just the such the, like the realistic depictions of slavery for me were just chilling in a whole different way, because it's just like, those are my ancestors. A Little Life is a difficult read because of the subject matter. Kindred is a difficult read because it's history that's shared through pain and trauma and just unimaginable tragedy. And that is my history.
Right.
You know, that I'm reading. So Kindred was a difficult read for me on a whole different level. But I mean, the reward in and of itself by finishing that book is just unparalleled. Like, I was like angry. I was hopeful. It was just so many things. Like, it just elicited like all of these emotions out of me that very few books are really able to do. Octavia Butler, like, just chef's kiss right there. Like, that's who I want to be like.
And do you normally read sci-fi, or was this a little bit of a one-off for sci-fi for you?
This was a one-off. And to me, it's not sci-fi. To me, it's more speculative fiction. So it was like speculative fiction to me, but Octavia Butler is not a one-off. Me reading sci-fi is, but Octavia Butler for me isn't a one-off. Like, right now I'm reading Fledgling, and then I'll probably just read everything she's written.
This one is on my list. I've been a little nervous because I sometimes have trouble with time travel books. I need to read this anyway.
Yeah, you need to read it anyway. You won't have to deal with it.
Yeah, and it sounds, the more I talk to people about it, the more it sounds like it is something that would work despite me thinking I have trouble with time travel books.
But it's not about that for me.
It's about other things.
Yeah, it's about other things. And I mean, like, you know, reading BIPOC authors is something a lot more people need to do. And it's because of books like this that I feel it just provides just like a gateway into a lot of the emotion and once again, like a lot of the history in terms of like, you know, the African-American experience in America. But you definitely need to read this one.
It's on my list. And that was Kindred by Octavia Butler. And tell me about the first new book you love.
Lisa Cross Smith's So We Can Glow. I never thought of myself as like a short story person. But Lisa Cross Smith, who blurbed Saving Ruby King, shout out to Lisa.
I saw that. Yeah.
She's awesome. Even more awesome is her writing. And the stories all range in size. There's one story, I think that's like just a paragraph or something like that. But like, they're all so well written. I mean, she's just the best storyteller. Like, I don't do camping, but if I did camping, I would want to sit across from Lisa Cross Smith so she could just tell me a bunch of stories. You know, I felt like I was there with each of her characters. They are so unapologetic in how they live their lives. It's really just a breath of fresh air. And she uses every word to just grab your attention. Before I knew it, I had like read over half the book in 2 days on the train. You know, she's phenomenal. Like, I go back and I reread parts of her book.
And have you read Whiskey and Ribbons as well?
Yeah. And I love Whiskey and Ribbons.
That's on my list too.
Yeah.
What I need is like 3 months of no new books being published so I can do some backlist.
Do you really want that, Sarah?
No, not really. But like, I keep a backlist TBR that's separate from my regular TBR, because my regular TBR is like by publication date each month and all the new things coming out. And I try to work in a backlist here and there, and it gets so, but I take December every year and I read all backlist in December. So,
ooh, I like that.
Yeah. So that's on it for this December. I've heard really good things about it. And did you know she has a new book coming out next year?
Yes. Yeah. This close to okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I pre-ordered that.
Oh, good. Yeah, it's coming out spring, and I don't think they have a set pub date yet, as far as I know.
Yeah.
So I have a question for you. How, I assume you read her work before Saving Ruby King was published, right?
Yes.
So how did you get her blurb?
I didn't think that it was going to be possible. So We Can Glow was not out. I had read Whiskey and Ribbons, and I knew about every Kiss of War. But my editor reached out to Lisa, and Lisa was extremely gracious and read the book, and she loved it. And when I got that blurb, I was like, what? And, you know, Lisa read the book, and I was just like, blown away. Because, I mean, I remember reading Whiskey and Ribbons and just being like, wow.
Right. She used a word to describe your book that I loved. Pedal down debut.
Yes.
I love that. That's so accurate.
When she said told with teeth and tenderness.
Yes.
Thank you.
I mean, that, just reading her writing and her, like, her word choice of your blurb, I'm like, I need to go read this woman for sure. All right, that was So We Can Glow by Lisa Cross Smith, and that came out in March, y'all. And tell me about the second new book you loved.
Oh, The Chiffon Trenches.
Yes.
Andre Talley is just, he's a larger-than-life person. And I remember the first time, I actually just happened to be watching a daytime talk show, like the Tamron Hall Show. And he was on the Tamron Hall Show. And he was talking about his book, The Chiffon Trenches. And I normally don't do memoirs. I normally really don't read memoirs. But like just like his energy, like just it got me. And he seemed like a really awesome guy. And I really had no clue about really who he was and that he had worked at Vogue and all of that. I had no clue. And so, like, you know, it was what you call like an impulse buy. It was one of the best impulse buys I ever did. I mean, like, I finished his book, I want to say, in about 3 days. And it was very hard to put down. His honesty is just, his bravery just, it leapt off the pages. And I mean, like, it's really just like a no-holds-barred account of what goes on in the fashion industry. And, like, him being, you know, Black and what it means to be Black and big and working with Anna, you know, working for Anna Wintour and all of that. And I mean, like, no punches was pulled.
None.
None. N-U-N. None. Normally, I don't read memoirs because I'm like, well, I mean, there's like, what are you getting ready to do? I already know what your life is like. And saw you live your life, you know, either on TV or, you know, or movies, or heard about you through news reports and news accounts. And I think what drew me is because I really didn't know very much about him. And to kind of learn about his life was fascinating. I honestly think that the way that he kind of would push for people to be seen who weren't kind of viewed as stereotypically beautiful, you know, dark skin, curvy bodies, like, hey, these people deserve to be recognized too in the fashion industry, despite your little, you know, your size prejudices, your outright overt racial prejudices. These people deserve to be seen. So, I mean, I just big ups to him for that. And just the book was just like so well written. I loved it.
I lived in New York City for 15 or so years before I moved back to my hometown. And so definitely I knew who he was and would see stuff about him in the news all the time. And I knew about that part of his life. What I didn't know was about his childhood growing up in the South and being a gay Black person in the South and how that was for him and the struggles he faced and abuse he faced. And I don't want to say I enjoyed it because that's there needs to be another word for books that you just love, but it's strange to say you enjoyed because they're about really traumatic things.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I'm not enjoying your pain.
No.
I think there's kind of a reverence there.
Yes, that's a great word. This is why you're the paid writer. And not me.
It's just like a reverence there for the bravery and the honesty that it takes to open your life up like that and to show yourself and to share your experiences, all the good, but just the horrible too.
I actually heard him on a podcast earlier this week, and he was saying he had never told anybody about what happened to him as a child prior to this book.
Right. And I think he also said, like, to this day, he still doesn't really like to be touched.
Fair.
And I'm like, well, makes sense.
Yep.
And despite all of that, like, he manages to have like this just crazy phenomenal career and still manages to push through. But see, that's what we do as Black people. Like I said, no matter what seems to happen to us, we can find a way to get through and amass opportunities that were probably undreamed, you know, not dreamed of or not thought of, you know, since our ancestors walked on these shores. But because of them, we're able to achieve these things.
Right.
Like, you know, saying we stand on the shoulders of giants is not a cliche for me. It is simply fact.
Absolutely. All right. That was The Chiffon Trenches by Andre Leon Talley. And that came out this April. And tell me about a book you did not love.
Yeah. So Life After Life by Kate Atkinson. And let me just preface this by saying Kate Atkinson is super talented, right? Super talented writer. I didn't connect with the characters. You know, I was just right. Like, meh, whatever. I don't care. Like, when you're African-American, you always have to push past, oh, there are only white characters on this show, in this movie. And then when you're younger, when I was younger, I didn't know to really ask for more. If more was presented to me, I was happy for it, but like, I didn't demand more, right? So then when it comes to, you know, books with all white characters, you know, a lot of times, like, I can kind of push past it, and sometimes I can't. And with this one, like, I just really couldn't necessarily push past the characters themselves.
Right.
It just wasn't a book for me. Once again,
that's fair.
Kate Atkinson is like, yeah, it's like super talented writer, right? Just this particular book wasn't for me. It doesn't mean like I'm never reading anything by her again. No, not at all.
This is one of those weird books that I think I have not read, but I'm not positive. A part of me, I read something by Kate Atkinson years and years ago. I don't remember what it was. And so clearly it did not leave a massive impression on me, right?
Yeah.
But it might have been a different book by her. That was Life After Life by Kate Atkinson. And by the way, I checked out Goodreads on this. And I know people kind of talk about this book sometimes. It's like this one of the books that has stood the test of time. But the reviews on Goodreads were really all over the map and pretty mixed. So I don't think you're alone. Let's talk about your new release, though, because I'm super excited about this one, too. Tell me about it.
Oh, my God. Zakiya Harris is just a cinnamon roll person. Like, she's a sweetheart. And she blurred my book, too. But I'm not giving her a shout out because she blurred my book. No. That's not how I roll. I just want to read about a Black woman in the publishing world and what pops up.
Yes.
Period. I need to read this. I want to read this. And it's also going to be a show, I think, on Hulu.
Yes. It's in development.
Yeah. Like, just the premise is kick ass. So, hey, like, I think this is going to be a book that, like, a lot of people are going to want to read. Definitely going to have a lot of buzz around it. It already has a lot of buzz around it.
Yes.
Next year, when it comes out, I'm definitely going to get it. And I think, you know, Zakiya is just, like, wonderful, and I really cannot wait to see what the other Black girl is about.
So when you were talking about earlier being sometimes the one or the two African-Americans at a company, my thoughts immediately went to this book because the inspiration for her writing this, and y'all, just as a little bit of background, the author, Zakiya Harris, was an assistant at Knopf Publishing. And she quit that job to write this book. And this is her debut novel. And she's only 27 years old. I feel super unaccomplished. But she was in the bathroom at work. And another African-American girl came out of a different bathroom stall. And she was kind of like, oh, I'm not the only one here. And that just sparked this idea to write a novel about being an African-American in the publishing world, which is, I think, as most listeners of this podcast probably know, overwhelmingly white.
So white.
Yeah. Like 76% white, to be exact.
And being a Black woman who is in the, you know, who's a writer, to try to get another Black editor is just, and then for me to get another Black editor who deals with literary fiction, I mean, they're not many, if
right,
I feel like they're very, very few. And would I have liked to work with a Black editor? Yes, I would still love to work with a Black editor. Laura Brown, however, for me is just phenomenal and we're a great match. So I'll continue to work with her for as long as she'll have me.
Sure.
But, you know, I would love to work with, you know, a Black editor on another book. But I mean, it's just like...
Hard to find right now, which needs to change.
Yeah, it absolutely needs to change. I mean, we need more, you know, African-Americans, Indigenous, Latinx. I mean, like, really from the top down. But that change is going to take a lot of time. What shouldn't or what can change immediately is how BIPOC authors are compensated for their books.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because when that publishing paid me hashtag came out,
yes,
we were all hot under the collar. We was all like, wait.
As you should be.
Like, how does somebody get paid $800,000? Like, how you're never even going to get that advance back.
All right. So, y'all, that was The Other Black Girl by Zakiya Harris. And it's coming out in 2021. But as far as I know, and tell me if you know any differently, they don't have a set pub date yet.
Not that I know of. I could be completely wrong. I haven't read about the set pub date.
And also, y'all, this book got a 7-figure deal.
Yeah, 7-figure advance.
That's huge and rare.
Yeah, it's 7-figure advance. And she, like I said, that show's supposed to be coming out on Hulu. So,
yep.
Hello.
It's going to be good.
It'll be very, very good.
Y'all know how I used to close out every episode with the Rate It game. And I told you in my little update episode that I'm trying something different now. So now I'm going to be closing out every episode with one final question. And I'm going to be asking every guest the same question. And we're going to try this out for a little while and see how it goes. Certainly open to changing it. If y'all don't like it, let me know. But my final question to you, Catherine, what is the last 5-star book you read?
We talked about A Little Life, but the other last 5-star book I read was Choke by Chuck Palahniuk.
Oh, I haven't heard of that one. Tell me about it.
Oh, my God. So Chuck Palahniuk is very, very good at doing, like, I can't even really describe his writing, but it's just like very good subversive prose books. Chuck Palahniuk, Fight Club.
Oh, okay. I know Fight Club. All right.
Yeah. So he wrote the book Fight Club. Choke came out, I want to say, in the early 2000s. And it focuses on this guy, Victor, and his mom, and like the really messed up relationship he has with his mom. And like one of the ways he gets by is to like pretend like to like choke on things. And then like people will save him. And then like they feel attached to him and he like gets things from them.
Huh. That's interesting.
It's a really interesting book. I didn't, you know, like there's a movie adaptation, but I would say read the book. With Fight Club, look at the movie, definitely. It's like peak Brad Pitt, right?
Right.
But with Choke and then his other book, Survivor, oh my God, 5-star reads, like across the board. I loved both of those books.
Y'all, that's Choke by Chuck Palahniuk. Was that right?
Palahniuk, UK.
Thank you so much. This has been wonderful.
Thank you. I had such a great time. I could talk books forever.
Me too. Y'all, the August Superlatives episode for patrons will air at the end of the month, and it will include Catherine's picks for categories like favorite novel about strong women and favorite debut novel. If you'd like to get this bonus episode plus others, you can support the show for $5 a month on Patreon. There's a link in my show notes and in my Instagram bio. And y'all remember that episodes will be airing bi-weekly until I can get a feel for my schedule at home. So in 2 weeks, which will be September 2nd, Catherine from Gilmore Guide to Books will be joining me for the fall 2020 book preview episode. Talk to you in 2 weeks. Thanks so much for listening to Sarah's Bookshelves Live. You can find show notes with all the books mentioned in the episode, purchase links, and linked timestamps at www.sarahsbookshelves.com/podcast. And that's Sarah with an H. I'd love to hear your comments, feedback, and suggestions. You can find me online on my blog, sarahsbookshelves.com, on Twitter at Sarah's Shelves, on Instagram at Sarah's Bookshelves, and via email at sarahsbookshelves@gmail.com. And if you'd like to get exclusive bonus episodes of the podcast, you can support us on Patreon at www.patreon.com/sarahsbookshelves. And there's a link in the show notes and in my Instagram bio to my Patreon page. Thanks for listening.